You're listening to an Iconic exclusive, which is an interview that we do with one of the industry designers or participators with 13th Age. Due to the nature of the interview, this podcast may run a little bit longer than our normal episodes, as we're just going to let the person we're interviewing talk and answer our questions, and we're going to have a good time doing it. So just be warned, this one may run longer than what you're normally used to listening to.
This is Iconic, with your hosts JM, Mark, and Nick.
Welcome to Iconic, where we talk about all things 13th Age. I'm your host, JM, and with me as always are Nick and Mark.
Hey.
Hello.
So this is our first Iconic bonus episode where we'll be talking about a game other than 13th Age, and with us today is author of Adventure Conqueror King, Alexander McCreese of Autark. Welcome.
Hello.
For those of you who don't know, Alex works as the general manager for The Escapists, and he was the lead designer on Adventure Conqueror King and wrote the Axe Player's Guide, and most recently released the Domains of War expansion for Adventure Conqueror King.
That's right.
So, Alex, how did you get into role-playing?
I got started role-playing when I was 5 years old, actually. My older brothers were 12 or 13, and it was 1979, 1980, and they actually had like Dungeons and Dragons courses in the high schools and clubs, and they learned how to play, and they needed another warm body to basically absorb casualties. And so as their little 5 and 6 year old brother, I got lumped in, and by 10, you know, I was running my own campaigns, and then you know, I got into second edition, and then from there I moved into Artelsorian Games, Cyberpunk 2020, which I ran for most of high school, some DC Heroes, some Ars Magica, so sort of all those 90s era games. And then when the OSR, you know, old school renaissance took hold, I got back in touch with D&D again.
That's great. And that led into the development of Adventure Conqueror King.
Yeah, it led straight into it. Really, it began with a campaign I was running using the Mold Day Basic set and the Cook Expert set, BX. And as I was running, I kept tinkering with the rules and changing this and streamlining that and revisiting this. And eventually, it turned into a system that, you know, seemed like, you know, would be something people would be interested in. That was my marketing master plan.
So how did you get involved with working with The Escapist?
I founded it.
Lucky you. That is not listed on your profile.
So tell us how did you come about founding The Escapist?
Great question. So I was at law school, and I was there 1997 to 2000. And in my last year of law school, I had basically taken all the hard courses. I had my job lined up to be a Wall Street corporate attorney. You know, I was ready to sell my soul for the big bucks. And then I took a course on internet law, and we had a guest professor one day who was like a 20-year-old college dropout who had founded RagingBull.com and taken it public. Like, in his guest lecture was basically how awesome it was to be a 20-year-old college dropout who founded RagingBull.com. And I was like, yeah, that does sound really awesome. So, you know, I raised my hand. I'm like, you know, what are the opportunities for lawyers in the internet economy? And this kid's like, oh, man, I hire lawyers all the time. There's no way. I just went through 3 years of Harvard Law School to go work for this kid on whatever his website is. I can do this. So I went back to my dorm room, and I told my roommate, I was like, we're starting a web company. And I called up my brother, and I'm like, Willie, you know how to program. We're starting a web company. And they were like, that's awesome. What's the business model? I had no idea. I mean, I had never even held like a job. But I was like, well, I really like video games and tabletop games. And so we started a website called Warcry. And then Warcry spawned a company called Themis, which did online game consulting and development. And then Themis in 2005, I was its founder and CEO. Themis then created The Escapist to be sort of a Rolling Stone for gamers kind of publication. And you know, The Escapist went on to win a bunch of Webby Awards, and, you know, we got Zero Punctuation, and grew our traffic pretty large. And then in 2012, I sold it to Alloy Digital, which then merged with Defy Media. And so now I'm senior vice president of Defy Media, and, you know, run a bunch of different web properties and gaming and men's lifestyle.
Wow, that's quite the story.
I wish I could claim that there was like some super awesome master plan behind it all, but it really was like an attempt to avoid, you know, having to actually go work as a lawyer, because that just seemed really dreadful.
So what upcoming industry product are you most excited about?
You know, I've been pretty impressed with 5th edition, I gotta say. So I pre-ordered the starter set, I downloaded the basic rules, and have been eagerly anticipating the Player's Companion coming out. We gave a lot of support to it on the Escapist, and Mike Morales was very generous, gave us some nice interviews, and he was actually a backer of Adventure Conqueror King and had very nice, very kind words to say about the game. So, and I think you can tell even just reading the product that, he has an affection for the old school styles of play as well. And so that makes me feel really happy, both because I like that style of play, and then as a business person, I think the more people that are exposed to it, sort of the more opportunity we have to get Axe players.
Yeah, I noticed his name on the list in the main book, and I was like, I wonder if this is actually Mike Merles or just another Mike Merles. So
no, it actually was him, and he told me he was really glad to see someone bring back a focus on endgame play and like mass combat and things like that. And if you notice, like, he's bringing those into 5th edition, so.
Yeah, I saw a article they did it on bringing back Battle System. So
mm-hmm. I have the original.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, which is pretty cool. So, a good thing for us, of course, is that everything we do at Axe is a lot more compatible with 5th edition than it was with 4th. So.
Oh, yeah.
So what are you currently playing?
In January of this year, I shut down my Axe campaign, which was on its, 300th session, in order to focus on writing Bloomermount. So I haven't been running anything for about 6 months, because I've been doing nothing but writing. I do play in a weekly game of Savage Worlds, which is run by my friend Mike Apps. He used to be the president of Epic Games, and he retired, and now he just hangs out and runs Savage Worlds, I guess. That's what you do after you've sold a super powerful video game company. I don't know, but it's pretty fun. So we're playing Deadlands, Savage World.
For our listeners who are predominantly 13th Age fans, how would you describe Axe and kind of give us a little history on, a little bit more in-depth history on how it came about? I know you mentioned it was a homebrew hack of BX, so.
So I would say Adventure Conqueror King system is different from other games within the OSR genre because it really puts the focus on that arc of traveling from just a low-level adventurer who makes his way from dungeon to dungeon up to the point where you are powerful in your world, not just because you're individually powerful, but because, you're the ruler of a realm or kingdom. And the name is drawn from the Conan series of novels where you had Conan the Adventurer, Conan the Conqueror, or Conan the King. Mm-hmm. And you see in his story arc the travel from barbarian to king. And that was really the experience we wanted to offer players. There had been some prior efforts in that regard. Mensur with the companion set was the first to really offer it. But we wanted to take it to another level and have endgame activities, not just for ruling a realm, but also for creating a thieves guild or running a network of caravans and ships from the ports of the world or, having your own wizard's tower and building a dungeon beneath it and populating it with monsters and then using those monsters to crossbreed other monsters. And so Axe ends up reflecting all of those activities. You can actually, if you'd like to in the game, build a wizard's tower, establish a dungeon underneath it, and there's game mechanics that will determine which monsters come to your dungeon and populate it. And then there's additional game mechanics you can use to crossbreed those monsters with other monsters to create new monster types. And then there's other game mechanics you can use to sell the monster parts for profit at local towns and cities. And then there's, other rules for what happens if the local thieves guild wants to try and steal the cargo of monster parts. And it all ties together really seamlessly with a really integrated economics engine so that you can get a sense of, how really valuable is this dragon sword in the context of a larger economy. How much money does a Dwarven Citadel likely have? And that sort of thing doesn't really matter if you're just controlling an individual wanderer whose role is always going to be going dungeon to dungeon or hex to hex, but which matters a lot when you're starting to think about integrated into the larger world. And in order to make that happen, we had to make a lot of modifications to the game because, even a cursory glance through the rules will show you that, D&D's economy has historically been pretty borked. And a lot of times they don't carry through on their own the implications of the game's underlying assumptions. And so we, you know, we either carry through on the assumptions or we change the assumptions to make them make sense economically, and ended up with a game that, you know, diverged in some interesting ways from the classic D&D while still being, I think, really broadly familiar.
That's one of the things that really appealed to me about Axe when I was originally looking at it, the internal consistency and the way the parts fit together. They're interconnected really well, as opposed to kind of being like, here's a system that we just put together because it works, and then here's another piece that operates more or less independent of anything else.
Right, right. That's been a real goal. And over time, I've tried to sort of expose more and more of the underlying framework to our players. So then the player's companion, which I think you have, exposes the framework of how you can build your own custom character classes that will work seamlessly with the ones that already exist. And it shows how all of the character classes in the game are actually built with the system. It also exposes a framework for creating new spells so that you can see, why Fireball is as powerful as it is, or, you know, how you could create a revised version of Charm Person or healing spells. And then again, in all the new spells in the Player's Companion were built with that system. In some future supplements, I'm going to do the same for, like, the monster system. Expose some more detail on the main mechanics and things like that. I think for people that really like world building and sort of worlds in motion, Axe has, I think, really strong appeal in that regard.
Cool. So for our listeners who are new to this, what version of D&D would you say Axe is closest to?
It's definitely closest to the old Red Box Dungeons & Dragons that was published in the early 1980s.
Okay, cool.
It's got a little bit of influence of second edition, a little bit of influence of third edition, and a lot of influence from history. So the pricing has been revised for history, particularly Domains at War. The historical influence is very, very evident. We also went back in some ways to some of the underlying roots of the game and looked for sort of key decision points that had been made that caused the game to play weirdly over time. And let me give a great example. If you go back to the very earliest versions of Dungeons & Dragons, Gary Gygax had a rule that when fighters were attacking normal creatures, they got one attack per hit die.
Oh, yeah.
And Dave Arneson had a rule that when fighters killed a creature, they got to attack again. These rules existed in, like, 75, 1976. But by the time you get to the 1981 basic set, fighters only attack once per round. And there's reasons for why that is, and sort of if you go step by step and you deconstruct it, you can see how that evolved. But the end result is then you get this situation where magic users are much more powerful than fighters by a few levels in, because the magic user is sleeping and fireballing, and the fighter's still getting one attack per round. So, you know, we went back with Axe and we said, what would happen if we actually restored this idea that fighters should get attack again every single time they kill something? We also gave them a scaling damage bonus. And as a result, mid-level to high-level fighter in Axe is exceptionally powerful. And the relationship between fighters and mages stays much more balanced in Axe than it does in some other editions. Mm-hmm. You know, it wasn't because we sat down and came up with innovative new mechanics. It was because we went back to the very, very core of the game and tried to understand what had made it work, and then where later designs had kind of added something without fully understanding what the long-term implications would be, and then sort of taking advantage of what we'd seen of 10 years of play, 20 years of play since then, and rethinking it. So it was almost, in a sense, it was neoclassical.
Cool. Yeah, one of the things that I noticed was that the Axe system uses the throw system for a resolution instead of a Thaco or to hit bonuses. Why did you settle on that as a resolution mechanic?
Probably the question I get asked more often than anything else. So it's a couple different things. So first off, my sense is that at the end of the day, what the player wants to know is what he needs to roll to succeed. And so by having everything defined as a throw, which is throw 11 plus to succeed on your saving throw versus paralyzation, throw 12 plus to succeed on open locks, the player can look at his sheet and he knows what he needs to succeed. And any other system, it always boils down to that's what you're trying to figure out, right? Like if you say it's difficulty 18 and you get plus 4 to hit, that still means the player needs to figure out he needs a 14 or higher. Okay? So that was one, is I thought it was there was a certain elegance and simplicity to the saving throw system, and so I rolled that out as our general mechanic. The other part is that I was frustrated as both a player and a judge with this tendency when you have variable difficulty classes that are set by the referee, with the tendency that the difficulty classes semi-arbitrarily scale up as the player advances in level, such that when I'm playing a first-level thief, it feels like I succeed, you know, 50% of the time on, you know, getting the trap. And when I'm a 10th level thief, it still kind of feels like I'm succeeding 50% of the time on getting the trap. And it's like all of the traps in the world just got harder to open because I leveled up, and there's some sense that the difficulty of tasks should be going up with level. And 4th edition made that explicit. The computer game Oblivion made it a nightmare of dynamic leveling, which I never forgave them for. And in Axe, I really wanted the focus to be on the fact that as you're advancing in the world, you are getting more powerful in the world. So tasks are not getting harder, they're getting easier for you, which is why as you advance in the world, the target numbers go down, and there isn't this sense that the judge is supposed to be modifying them to keep like some arbitrary level of challenge for the thief or arbitrary level of challenge for the saving throw. You're genuinely supposed to see that, in fact, you are becoming more heroic within an objective world that exists outside of your character.
Yeah, I think I remember reading an article. I want to say it was by John Wick during the height of 3.5, where he was like, they named the title the D20 system was off by an order of magnitude. It should have been the D2 system. Flip a coin, heads you succeed, tails you fail, because everything,
exactly,
everything scaled as you leveled up.
That's exactly right. And so the throw system prevents that, and And when the GM imposes penalties on your throws, they're very, very transparent. And so you get the sense within the world that, oh, this is a really complex lock because it's giving me a -4 penalty. And if all of a sudden all the locks start giving you -4 penalties, then you start to give your GM the steely eye and be like, you know, what's up?
All right, so you kind of touched a little bit on Axe's focus on the end game and moving out of the dungeon and into rulership. Why did you settle on that? How did you come to realize the higher level rules of the game?
Well, so there's a couple answers there. One, I think it's my latent megalomania.
Oh, okay.
You know, I thought to myself, well, what would I like to do with the completion of the campaign? Obviously, I would like to be, you know, emperor of all I survey. Two, I think it shows up in most myth and legend. And history, and I wanted to reflect that. So if you think about, you know, Beowulf, well, he ends up as a king. You know, Odysseus, he returns home to be a king. Aragorn, he becomes a king. Conan, he becomes a king. Most of the great heroes that sort of inspired the whole genre are really embedded in worlds where their personal power translates into political power. Three, I come from a wargaming background. The first game I ever designed was a war game. And I felt like a real focus on good wargame mechanics was something that had been lacking, and it was a market niche we could fill and really offer a good experience. So,
okay. Well, you mentioned that Axe kind of came out of a campaign, and I believe, was that the original, is it Arryn Empire?
Yeah, the original Arryn Empire campaign, yep, which started with... The setting was designed to be used with classic D&D. It was called the Borderlands. The Arryn Empire predated it. I had used it in several other campaigns in different forms under different rule sets. Our very first dungeon, we ran Keep on the Borderlands, and you know, we grew it from there. And the players ended up taking control of the Borderlands, defeating you know, the antagonist in the area, but not really stopping his ultimate plan. And the whole world fell into disorder. The Arryn Empire collapsed, and they carved out an independent province. The majority of the Arryn Empire actually was seized by the forces of chaos in the original campaign. So it's pretty dark.
I know you have plans to release the campaign book for the Arryn Empire. Is it going to be the Fallen Empire? Is it going to predate that? What's kind of the back?
Yeah, it's gonna be before my players blow it up. Yeah, definitely.
Well, good. I hate when players do that.
Don't they always? The Arryn Empire setting is loosely based on late antiquity in the Mediterranean. The Arryn Empire is an empire that was established out of a religious crusade that toppled the prior Zaharan Empire. but it has since fallen into decay. It was once a republic. Now it's a military dictatorship. Different, you know, patrician and senatorial families are quarreling over who will be, who will be the Tarkhan of the empire. Meanwhile, the border provinces are falling into the hands of independent warlords or being overrun by beastmen. Essentially, all of the high-level people that could do anything about it are all in the capital skirmishing to become rulers, and the low-level players out on the provinces are left to fend to themselves and deal with, increasing existential threats. And generally, I've run the campaign a few different times, run in different areas, and generally what you see is the early levels, they're just adventuring. The mid-levels, they begin to awaken to the problems of the wider world, and then by the high levels, they kind of have to decide if they want to feed off the corpse and get what they can while they can, or if they want to try and change the world for the better. So it's neat. It's similar in a sense to the way Game of Thrones has the existential threat north of the wall, but no one's paying attention to it because they're too busy trying to rule the Iron Throne. That works well for this sort of a campaign environment where you're going from adventurer to king.
I like the way you explained the existential threats in relationship to law and neutrality and chaos throughout the Axe book. I feel like that fits very well with a classical base setting where you have like the people who are striving to forward society, civilization, people who are just using civilization for their own benefit, the neutral, and then the outside forces who are trying to pull it down with chaos. Why did you end up going with the more classic three alignment axis?
That was a great question. I think the nine-factor alignment system can be made to make sense, and I've actually written an article on the Escapists about how I make sense of it. But for the most part, in most campaigns, it ends up being more trouble than it's worth. Our society can barely agree on what's good anymore. We don't, as a society, really have a shared sense of the good anymore. And so players end up having vast disagreements about what is good and what is evil. And to this day, 12 years later, my group is still arguing about whether it was right or not for a paladin to kill baby kobolds in one campaign we ran. And I think that sort of petty argument over good and evil actually causes the players to lose sight of the grand sweep of what alignment should be. And so I wanted it to be more like what you'd see in a war movie. And you can think of like a World War II movie. Inglourious Basterds is a great example, right? The Inglourious Basterds are bastards, but they're allies, so therefore they're good. Or you might imagine Erwin Rommel, who was, by all accounts, a pretty decent guy, good family man. You know, if you were an officer, you could sit down and have tea with him and have a nice conversation. He didn't torture prisoners, but he was an Axis, so therefore he was a bad guy. And I was inspired a little bit by Poole Anderson's original writings in Three Hearts and Three Lions on how he described law as the allies and chaos as the axis in the present day. And so it just kind of emerged in play to be a much better way to get the feel I was looking for. And, you know, and the nice thing is it avoids the players having to sit there and second guess, you know, is the GM going to think this is an evil act or et cetera, et cetera. And you really, you know, all you really end up looking at is, are the players doing this for their own selfish ends, in which case it's neutral? Are the players doing it because they genuinely care about their civilization and want to fight off barbarism and chaos, you know, or are they just feeding on the corpse and bringing it all down and having a good time as it burns, and that's chaos.
James is cheering you, by the way.
What is he cheering me for?
Oh, the chaos part. The chaos that part. Is, I will say, and Mark and Nick are players in most of my games. And the world that I run in is very much law versus chaos as opposed to good versus evil.
Right.
And I think it's because I read Three Hearts and Three Lions was probably the first fantasy book I read. And so that's the lens I tend to view a lot of my games through.
Just such a great book.
Yeah.
And so influential on D&D in ways that people who haven't read that book can't understand.
It's where paladins come from.
For paladins, trolls, oh. In many ways, I think elves.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a marvelous, marvelous book.
Yeah. Well, I'm really you piqued my curiosity. I will have to look at that article that you mentioned, and I will track it down, put a link to it in the show notes. Very interesting concept.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, the article is pretty funny. It basically says, you know, you have to think of law neutral and chaos as whether or not you're a deontological, area theological, or consequentialist thinker. And then good, neutral, mean, evil will tell you how large your moral circle is. So if you're chaotic, you're purely consequentialist based. So you're always thinking like, what will have the best outcome? And there's no fixed rules. And then if you're lawful, you're deontological. So you're like, these are the rules. And if I follow the rules, it yields. It doesn't matter what the outcome is because ethics is about following the rules. But you could be lawful evil, being you have a strict set of principles that you think will lead to, you know, your maximum welfare. Or you could be chaotic good and always trying to be sort of, you know, oh, I made a white lie and I stole, but it was all for the greater good. And it actually makes the whole system make sense. But most people really, the moment they read the word deontological, they sort of stop reading the article. So
I know I would.
Yeah, they're like, he just referenced Kant and I don't even know who that is. So,
Domains at War just released as a mass combat and campaigning system for use with Axe. Our listeners who are primarily 13th Age players, can you give a brief introduction to the product?
Yeah, absolutely. All right, so Domains at War is a two-part product. There's Domains at War Battles and Domains at War Campaigns. Domains at War Campaigns is everything you need to know to raise armies. And then to sort of maneuver the armies on the battlefield. So it's like the strategic level. It's got all sorts of neat stuff like, you know, how many soldiers can you raise from a village? You know, how long does it take to train heavy infantry? What are the capabilities of goblin wolf riders versus orc, you know, boar riders? And it's heavily grounded in history, so you could use it to rebuild the armies of Alexander or Rome. But it's fully enabled for fantasy as well. So you could use Domains at War Campaigns to work out the logistics and the maneuvering of an army made up of mounted Tyrannosaurus riders with pterodactyl scouts. And it's all in there. It's got rules for supply. It's got rules for sort of random events in war, which are really fun. And it's also got a simplified battle system where you can abstractly resolve combat. And then allows your players to do heroic forays where you kind of zoom into one scene on the action where they influence the battle. And that's for the judge who doesn't necessarily care so much about the details of the tactical war game. He wants to be able to tell an interesting war story. He wants the players to be able to influence the war story. And he's happy to sort of abstract exactly what happens on the left flank where the hoplites smash into the orc skirmishers. Domains at War Battles is a tabletop war game that's played with miniatures and counters and hexes. It would be, you know, a familiar sort of game to anyone who's ever played, Memoir 44 or Battle Lore or Warhammer. And it takes the armies that you've raised in Domains at War Campaigns and allows you to fight the battles right on your battlefield. It's got several different scales. You can do skirmish level battles where each unit represents 30 men. You can do company level battles where each unit represents 120 soldiers, all the way up to brigade level battles where each unit represents 2,000 soldiers. And there's different rules for the effects of spells and heroes at each scale. And everything is completely compatible and streamlined right into Axe or similar games. So armor class, hit dice, attack throws, damage, all the spells, everything. Just completely compatible, and every spell in the game and every magic item in the game has rules to be used with in Domains at War Battles. So, you know, down to the level of detail that if you wanted to know what would happen if you used a crystal ball to read the mind of the enemy general while your mage was casting Move Earth to knock open the walls of the enemy tower and then rushed it with Triceratops, like, you can do that. Or you can just use it for a very straightforward simulator of more medieval-style combat.
That's really cool. And kind of touches on the next question I had about how easy is it to convert other D20 systems to use with Domains at War?
I would think it's pretty easy. It depends how much you want it to be an exact mechanical analog. So we really wanted Domains at War that if you fought the battle in Domains at War, the outcome you get would be the same outcome you would get if you actually had time to fight it out in one-to-one scale with 10,000 players. And so the math is kind of carefully calibrated to sort of yield results that make sense, which is something I think other games like Battle System and the War Machine haven't done as well. You would often get these situations where you're like, I don't think that's how it would have played out if the actual D&D rules applied, and we wanted to avoid that. To the extent that the game you're converting from is very different than Axe, then the analog won't be as close. But I would say, I mean, I've personally used it with 3.5. I've used it with first edition. I've used it with basic, and it works really well. I imagine it would work pretty well with fifth. I don't think it would work very well with fourth, because fourth has some very, very, very different assumptions. And I've never tested it with any of some of the other latest generation RPGs like 13th Age or Numenera or whatnot. But I imagine if you're a clever enough DM that you're listening to a podcast like this, you could make it work.
I got to play one game of Battles so far with a buddy of mine, and he thoroughly trounced me with the Beastmen in that opening scenario. Yeah.
Did you play the introductory scenario?
I did. My dice were not with me, and he completely collapsed both of my flanks, and I assume used my corpses to feed his war riders.
There's rules for that.
I know. That was talking with him about that. He likes the fact that he knows how much an ogre mercenary would cost him, and that he can feed his captives as opposed to try and get information out of him.
Right. Fun.
So the next product you have coming out is Dwemer Mount, correct?
That's right.
What
the mega dungeon to end all mega dungeons.
Tell us about it.
So Dwemer Mount was originally created and conceived by James Malczewski on his blog Bronyardia back in 2009. It was his own experiment in what it would be like to run a Gygaxian mega dungeon. And the dungeon is mega. It's 13 levels, something like 700 rooms. The collected book is 400 pages long. James wrote the first draft of the product and then handed it off to Tavis Allison and I, and we've carried the project through completion. We tackled some pretty serious delays. It's, I think, closing in on 18 months to 2 years late at this point. But I think the final product will be really worth it. It's really robust. It comes with a complete campaign system. It has tons and tons of new monsters, tons of new magic items. And every single room is statted and fleshed out and ready to go for 13 levels. And it comes with its own wilderness gazetteer to let you embed the dungeon into a campaign. So you could basically just buy this book and you would have a campaign that would take your characters from first to 14th level. Done.
Does it come with its own setting, or would a GM be able to inject it into their own setting?
It does come with its own setting, the world of Telluria. But I think certainly a GM could insert into its own setting. And I know several GMs on the Altark forums have already started to do that.
Cool. When can we expect to see its release?
We are actually going to be distributing the final proof to our backers today or tomorrow. They're going to give them about a week to make sure that we got their names right in our little thank you section. And then it's going to go to printers. So I believe Tavis will have some pre-release copies with him at Gen Con. And then it will be done and in print by third or fourth week of August, and about a month later, we'll have an Axe-compatible version. This first version is Labyrinth Lord-compatible. We'll have an Axe-compatible version, and it will be in Flagship Gaming Store by October for sure.
Excellent. Well, what else is on the release schedule for Autark? What do you have? What are you tackling next?
Gosh, so we have a product called Layers and Encounters, which is designed for sandbox campaign settings. In Axe, we introduced the concept of dynamic layers, which is the idea that you shouldn't put all your points of interest on the map. You should reserve a bunch of points of interest to use as randomly generated layers when the players explore. But to make that work, you have to have lots of randomly generated layers that you can insert anywhere. And so what Layers and Encounters is a dynamic layer for every monster in the game, fleshed out with treasure, points of interest, etc. It also includes some more advanced rules for adventuring in the wilderness, and exploring layers with things like, how long would it take if I wanted to thoroughly search a 6-mile hex to find every layer in the hex? How long would it take if I was doing it from the air? What if we split up? What if we split up in the air while using a crystal ball, etc.? And it's also got some advanced rules on building out monster layers and things like that. What's the value of ivory and leather? And, if you capture a baby monster and you take him to market, how much can you sell him for and things like that? So I think it'll be a really nice tool for sandbox GMs. I'm also working on right now something called the Heroic Companion or Hero Conqueror King. I haven't decided on the final title. And that is intended to allow you to more accurately run games that are similar to Conan or Middle Earth, where magic is a little more rare and and the gameplay feels a little bit more like historical and literary sagas or fiction inspired by that.
Cool.
Sounds like you got your work cut out for you.
It's a hobby.
And then after that, the Auron Empire?
Yeah, the Auron Empire campaign setting is something I'm constantly working on in the back backdrop. I think I currently have maybe 300 pages written, but it's not in the sort of coherent framework where I would feel anyone else could understand it yet. So it's kind of a matter of slowly shaping what has organically grown over years and years and years of time into something that others can understand and use. And of course, having been the thing I worked on the longest, it's what I'm most paranoid about releasing, because God forbid it doesn't do well and people are like, oh, I really thought this would be better. You know, every creator hears that.
Hey, you can always go back to being a Wall Street lawyer.
Oh, God. That's too late for me, man. They look at my Twitter, they're like, yeah, this dude is weird. My boss called me up one day here at Define Media, and he was like, did I just see you make a tweet about Dungeons & Dragons? I was like, yeah, I just finished my Monday night game. And he was like, you are a 39-year-old man, right? I was like, oh, burn. But I think being a tabletop gamer is like being in a secret society within the business world. You know, you'll throw out a little joke like, oh, I rolled a one or failed my saving throw or something. And then like the other guy in the room gets it. And then you do the secret handshake. And then like you can do multi-million-dollar deals together.
It's kind of like Fight Club. You can tell who's in it, but you don't talk about it.
That's right.
Exactly.
Well, that's the questions we had. Guys, any last questions for as we wrap up?
No.
Alex, any questions for us?
I'm interested, as 13th Age players, you know, and you've got experience with Axe, like, what's your own sense? Do you think it would be easy to use with Domains at War? Like, have you thought about, have you ever tried any of the domain mechanics in that system? You know, I have not myself tried to convert, although several of my players in my Axe campaign speak really highly of 13th Age, so I'm sure they would be interested in your thoughts.
I have not tried to convert yet, but when I was writing up my review, it was very easy for me to see, because it's based off of 3, 5, and 4, you have the same hit dice and level to hit rolls, damage, and AC that you would need to convert the monsters. The special powers, 13th Age monsters work a lot like 4th edition monsters, where instead of having just a to hit, they have special abilities. So I think that would be the hardest thing to port over, require a little bit more mm-hmm. hacking. But again, it comes from the same basic set of mechanics. So
yeah. Cool.
Yeah.
Well, if you give any experiments on it, I'd be curious what happens.
I will let you know.
Yeah, totally.
Well, thank you for coming on. I know you mentioned Tavis was going to be at Gen Con. Will you be at Gen Con as well, or?
No, we drew lots, and Tavis gets to go to Gen Con, and I get to stay home and write. So I feel good about that. He got the worst end of it, but he'll tough it out. He's going to be there actually running Adventure Conquer King system. He's going to be running an adventure called Secrets of the Undercity. So that should be fun for the folks that are in that. And we'll have some copies of Domains at War available for purchase at the Studio 2 booth, if anybody wants to check that out.
Well, thank you for your time and for coming on, and hopefully we'll have you on again.
Hey, thanks so much. It was a pleasure to be on with you guys.
Well, you've been listening to the Iconic Podcast.
If you have any questions or comments, you can contact us at whitedragon@iconicpodcast.com. or call and leave a voicemail at 720-924-1706.
And check out iconicpodcast.com for news, updates, and new episodes.
Thanks for listening.